Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. We've officially entered the second month of the U.S. government shutdown with no real end in sight. In a recent article, award-winning print and broadcast journalist Bob Hennelly reported on programs New York State is offering to thousands of federal employees who've been working without pay or who have been furloughed to help them weather the economic hardships that they are encountering. He joins us now to discuss that and his two-part article in Salon headed, "It's Time for a General Strike Against Trump." I'm pleased to welcome Bob Hennelly back to WBAI and to our show. Hi, Bob.
It's a pleasure, Leonard. It's been a long time.
Well, I'm glad that we finally were able to get together again. The Senate is preparing to vote on 2 measures to end the government shutdown tomorrow. I've been wondering, why not yesterday or today?
Well, I guess it's the procedural votes. It's widely expected that neither Mr. McConnell's proposal nor Senator Schumer's proposal will get the 60 votes prerequisite to move this dreadful narrative on. My eyes, quite frankly, are on what happens or what has already happened at the Hart office building, where the American Federation of Government Employees, which represents the lion's share of the 2 million federal workers, are going to get a little more militant and actually have a staged takeover.
You've been covering public unions and civil service for the chief leader.
Right.
So are you in touch with – are you finding out things that the rest of us don't know?
I would say that the chief leader has been on newsstands since 1897. It's privately held. But we've been covering the Federal Civil Service, and the advantage we have is we've been paying attention right along. And so in the case of Donald Trump, the shutdown just really reflects – what is 2 years of a direct assault by Donald Trump on labor, including trying to get rid of shop stewards, trying to get rid of the presence of unions. It's very important for people to understand federal unions are very different than any other kind of union you think about. They are 1962, President Kennedy signed the order which cleared the way for a form of bargaining and representation. But in terms of traditional things we think of unions having, like pay, that's a discretion of Congress. So the things that federal unions have oversight over are things like seniority, things like workplace environment, things like terms and conditions of employment. And so also these unions are voluntary. So it's not like you have a closed shop like you were used to if you've worked for SAG-AFTRA or any place else where if you're in a union shop, you have to join. So these unions, and that's like the National Taxpayers the National Treasury Employees Union and AFGE, all of them require voluntary subscription to the union.
TSA has its own union.
Right. So all of these things, they can't compel membership. So it really requires that, unlike some of the more the established unions where you have huge salaries at the top where people can take for granted that they're going to get their vice president union salary, these folks have to earn it every day to keep the level of membership up and keep engagement going.
As I said, you've been reporting on what the shutdown means to Americans all over the country. Is there anything the mainstream media have missed about the situation?
Well, I think the key thing here is that it has been what I refer to as the C block story. So you have the A block. If you're MSNBC, it's about Putin and the dynamic of Trump and the ongoing Mueller investigation. And the government shutdown and the lockout of employees is kind of like the weather. It's brought up at the end as kind of like wallpaper. But the reality is that what this is exposing is that we're all, in the sense of what's happening to our economy, federal workers in the sense that we struggle week to week. And what is amazing is organized labor, I believe, is missing an opportunity to make this connection. The fact that federal workers are now in the throes of all kinds of things, foreclosure and all kinds of things, they're emblematic of what's happened to the larger American workforce. And you can trace it, ironically, back to PATCO, to the decision in 1981 by Reagan to break that strike and fire all 11,000 air traffic controllers.
But as you point out, the unions for federal employees are not the same as other unions, and some of the unions around the country supported Donald Trump's election bid.
Well, it's more, I would say, I only know of one or two, the Custom Border Protection Union. What happened was...
Mine Workers?
Well, what happened here was a split, though. The real issue, the big story, was that rank-and-file union members, like even the AFGE, I've had political people who are like involved with political organizing within AFGE tell me that they estimate 40% of government workers in some states voted for Trump. So the big question here was there was a split between the leadership and the rank and file, and that's happened before in America.
Although it is interesting that the president constantly insists that the people who are being furloughed or put out of work are mostly Democrats.
Right. Well, of course, the thing that he hasn't really – it was ironic. Another irony is that Trump got the presidency basically, aside from whatever help he got from the Russians, but by flipping 70 congressional districts that had gone for Obama twice in 2008 and 2012 in places like Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. These are places that hope and change became moldy because there was no recovery. And that's the other thing here is that there was no recovery for so many tens of millions of Americans. And so he's actually gone back and betrayed his base, and I already see that he's undermining that core of support.
I'm going to quote, this is a slightly long quote. I usually don't speak this long. You write, "The need for a mass mobilization has been building for a long time, and our electoral politics are not fast acting enough to relieve the nation and the world of the lunacy that's in the White House. Daddy or Mommy, where were you when that dangerous person was running the country? The answer, well, I was waiting for 2020 to fix it." And you say that won't wash.
Well, I think we're really upon a place where it's up to us to redeem this democracy. And I'm not being, I don't think I'm overstating it, because all the institutions that were put in place by the framers are failing. And this has been happening, as I said, for a long time. If you look at the subversion of democracy in 2000, where popular votes didn't matter.
Well, the Electoral College was put in as a defense, a way of defending the slave states. And you would have thought by now we would have gotten rid of it.
Well, in 2016, the same thing happened. And also, we've had a Congress that has totally abdicated its war powers responsibility. So we've had a war that's continued, a war on terrorism, which has proliferated terrorism and taken a tremendous toll on particularly the working class Americans who step up and because of the voluntary military draft. So on many levels, even the fact that the Senate couldn't protect its own prerogative to confirm Acting Attorney General Whitaker shows you that the people we've elected to these exalted positions don't have the Constitution in order to preserve the Republic. So it's up for people to redeem that by getting in the streets.
Now, your article in Salon, are you suggesting that the best way to get past this is a general strike?
Absolutely, because it will, in one instant moment, and there's a couple of isolated precedents in history, very isolated things where, and when I say general, it means across all different industries. The reality is that this is a turning point in American history, and it's not just another day in the debate chamber. This is something where the United States government has set the precedent of really what amounts to a violation of the 13th Amendment on a huge scale of having people work for free. And this workforce is, a lot of them are people of color and women. So this is moving this country backward. As a matter of fact, as I pointed out in a follow-up, ironically, we're in a worse state in terms of these issues of social economic justice as exhibited by this than when Dr. King died.
Now, Barbara Ehrenreich and Gary Stevenson have suggested a wildcat strike by the TSA, but you're talking about a general strike, which many people would see as almost un-American. It's the sort of thing that we expect in other countries.
Right.
But
well, I think
not in the U.S. Have we ever had anything that even approximated
a general strike? No, there's been isolated situations. You had the great silk strikes in Patterson where it was geographically based, but something on scale, no. And one of the problems, though, is that Americans are unaware of their own militant labor history. They're unaware of the fact that farmers during the Depression organized to prevent the banks from foreclosing on farmers. There are evidence of even the American Revolution. There was a case where a moment where people stood up and said, I'm willing to put something at risk because the current circumstances is not tolerable. And I think we're there now.
But I haven't heard anyone in a position, a leadership position, proposing something like a general strike.
That should tell you something, because unfortunately we have a culture of professional leaders. And I say that because I've worked in organized labor in fairly high positions, as a, you know, involved with politics and organizing. And one of the problems is people have a vested interest. If you're making $300,000-$400,000 a year as a labor leader, then you're going to be a little risk averse. And I think also this is a case where so often the people have to lead the leaders because they're stuck in this miasma. And we have to do something that is really new because the times are presenting us challenges we've never seen before.
Do you see it as ironic that Vice President Mike Pence declared that the U.S. is willing to give unwavering support to planned mass protests in Venezuela against President Maduro?
Well, I think it shows that he understands how political economy works. But this disconnect that's happened between the electorate and the national leadership has been brewing for a long time, and that's one of the reasons why, for instance, the intelligentsia, and I think even Donald Trump, were caught by surprise that he won. I mean, everywhere, and I was writing in Salon about the rise of white poverty. I mean, this country, if you listen to the mainstream corporate news media, they'll tell you that the economy has never been more prosperous. It's unprecedented expansion. Meanwhile, try this fun fact. Life expectancy has declined for 3 years in a row in the United States. Usually that's something that we say, well, that country's not doing so well. Maybe we shouldn't make any investment there because they haven't straightened themselves out. So by every important criteria, this country has been slipping for a long time.
You quote a recent New York Times article by Elisa Court.
Yeah. Well, this is, I think she's tapped into something about the fact, when you said before, why is it no one else has stepped forward to talk about this? Americans have hardwired in them a sense that they need to keep their economic circumstance private, that everyone else is doing well. And that's part of this mass culture of consumerism. Everyone is advancing very nicely. You, however, have a problem. And so we're ashamed. And so a big roadblock to organizing is getting people to step forward and own their circumstance and in that find the ability to make social change.
We have had a number of protest marches in this country. Of course, we've protested wars, and there have been the women's marches recently, but nothing like what we see in France. And
right,
there have been general strikes in France.
Right. In fact, in the European labor movement in general, there's more of a sense of solidarity and social cohesion. We are, you know, we've gone through a period where very skillfully people like Scott Walker in Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker and Governor Christie, came up with a playbook as we saw the diminishment of work and the slide of the social contract between Americans in all situations. These guys skillfully figured out, hey, let's play the public sector worker off of everybody else, because the public worker has what everybody used to have, which is health care and a decent social contract. And so they rose to power playing off this envy, and people even did things like attack school teachers because it was considered like they have benefits. How dare they? And that's how successful the Koch brothers machine has been at convincing people that they really don't deserve a reasonable social contract when it comes to work.
What's the average salary of a federal worker?
It's in the $86,000 range, but
which is comfortable.
Right, but you have about 111,000 that are below 50,000.
TSA workers make $30,000 a year?
Right, depending on where they are in their pay scale. And those are the folks, also I've been in contact with a lot of people, the Bureau of Prisons. These are people that are guarding some very serious, in very difficult situations, very stressful. They're now required to work, not being paid, and in many cases, because they make $45,000 or $50,000 a year, they can't afford to live near these places, so they're spending $400 a month in commutation. It's just untenable.
Didn't Donald Trump imply that he would dismantle the federal government if he was elected?
Yeah, that was...
So isn't he just doing what he promised?
Thank you. I mean, this is the thing that you've not heard, which is... And that's why, because it's a C block, it really should be the lead story. This is something that Newt Gingrich, who was...
Well, you have to explain C block, A block.
Yeah, well,
to,
of course.
People who are not in the business.
I don't know. You've got a very savvy audience. But C block is the last thing. So you divide your broadcast clock into three segments, A, B, and C. And so if you don't get to C, well, that's no loss. And so that's kind of why we haven't really heard as much about this shutdown. Now, back to this question about his very calculated decision to dismantle the government. Newt Gingrich, who was one of his transition people, said, the people that work for the government are your enemy. You need to treat them accordingly. And so there's been, and long before Trump came on the scene, the reactionary right has been moving to dismantle the federal government because they believe its very existence is a threat to freedom. And that is something that is now has a hold with enough people that they can hold the United States hostage. And that's what's going on.
My guest is Bob Henley, who has written and reported for The Village Voice, Pacifica Radio, WNYC, CBS Money Watch, and other outlets. He's now a reporter for the Chief Leader, covering public unions and civil service in New York and the country. You can also follow him on Twitter at StuckNation.
Yes, exactly.
And this is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. What are some of the actions being taken by the New York State Legislature to help these workers out?
Well, it's executive action because it has to happen so quickly. And what Governor Cuomo has done, and there's other governors doing the same thing, is expediting the ability of federal workers to apply for general welfare funds, because without some kind of executive stipulation, generally people that have just come out of work of a certain socioeconomic background, like if they own their own home, for instance, wouldn't qualify for relief. The other problem is navigating unemployment, because here's a crazy thing. I learned this on a picket line at 26 Federal Plaza. One of the things is that if you're ordered to work but not being paid, you can't put in for your unemployment claim because you're considered gainfully employed, even though you're not being paid. So that's why these people that are showing up every day, they really have a cash flow problem.
That's despite the 13th Amendment?
Right. Well, exactly. In fact, there's the National Treasury Employees Union is suing on the grounds that this current circumstance is a violation of the Constitution and that amendment particularly.
Good luck with this current Supreme Court. Right. Also, many require approval to get an outside job, but they can't get approval because the government is shut down.
Well, and this goes to the other thing, which is the long term.
This is not walking dogs or what some of the other things that were suggested.
Well, depending on the position too, because some of them are sensitive security positions. There was a very effective FBI Agents Association presser yesterday, which laid out the damage being done to that law enforcement agency, both in terms of the families and the functioning of law enforcement. One of the things about what's happening in terms of there's going to be long-term damage in our society, as anybody knows, with analytics the way it is, once you have a 30 or 45-day hiccup, you have a problem in terms of being able to get credit. And that doesn't let up. It's not like experiences, oh, look, there's an asterisk. He was a federal employee. Oh, he was an FBI agent. It doesn't matter. This is kind of like, artificial intelligence. The decision is made, the die is cast, irrespective of the fact it's through no fault of your own. And that's a kind of damage. And this is on top of, I might add, Leonard, the massive data breach that happened that people don't talk about anymore. The Office of Personnel Management, which was the huge federal government human resource machine, ended up being hacked. So like several million people in these positions had all of their most personal information hacked. And that's still an issue that the government hasn't fully come to terms with.
Is there another irony in the fact that the president is saying that building this wall, or whatever we're going to call it now, is a matter of national security, at the same time that the FBI is saying that the shutdown is doing real damage to several investigations and counter-terrorist measures?
Well, and it goes even deeper than that. The Custom Border Patrol, which I've written a lot about, has had some real problems staffing up. And part of the problem here is that a majority of the people applying historically have failed the lie detector test. And
do we know why?
Well, this goes back to during the period of time of national emergency known as 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security, which kind of came out of thin air, but really had been created as a concept years before by a commission that looked at the imminent attack of the United States. That's another story for another hour. But what happened here is that these institutions were created overnight, throwing together these institutions that had existed independently. And so all of a sudden they create this bureaucracy and they staffed up and they kind of did not do the due diligence that was required. And funny thing happened, as they threw the net wider and wider to bring more and more people into Custom Border Patrol, people got in who could be bribed. And so they went through a series of very embarrassing situations where there were all kinds of plots where people were selling access to the border. And I'd submit to you that what Donald Trump is doing now is setting up that same occasion for sin that was a problem in the 2000s.
An invitation to corruption.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're up against and you're worried about losing your house, and then you're on the front lines out in a border somewhere, and you don't want to revert to this transaction, you're creating all kinds of incentives. And so they never even staffed up to what he talked about doing. And that's I think, the problem here. Is I also think I look at what's happening here. We should look at the shutdown as an extension of his criminal obstruction of the investigation. I don't think it's any accident that this is taking a toll on the Federal Bureau of Investigation or the Department of Justice. I think this chaos suits him gumming up the works.
Because right after he became president, he started attacking the FBI.
Right.
As a kind of an enemy of the people.
And that's the other thing, too, is that you think that the Russian oil industry is upset that right now in North Arctic, on the borderline between U.S. coastal and Canadian waters in Russia, that there may not be the same muscular Coast Guard presence? You think they're upset about that? Do you?
You reported on President Trump's national address this past Saturday, his second in 2 weeks, and you wrote, "The president took to the airwaves and cast himself as the spaghetti Western protector-in-chief of a nation whose very existence was imperiled by a massive marauding migration of criminals from the South."
Well, and that is the worldview that he is peddling. And the thing is, it's just so difficult for me to process in some ways, is as a beat reporter that's been writing, I guess, about New York City for the last 30 years, the thing for me has been the dramatic drop in crime. I mean, and we lived and worked through this period of time. You had a city that at one point had over 2,000 homicides a year. Now it's below 400.
The 60s were a dangerous time.
Well, but look, at the change that happened wasn't the police force. It was the presence of undocumented families that stabilized these neighborhoods. Because the only thing undocumented people really care about, if you know any of these people, is work, family, and faith. That's what they got going on. Now, are there people that are problematic? Absolutely. Do they exploit that within their community in terms of silence? Yes, they do. But there's tons of data that shows that this population is less likely to commit crime and indeed are stabilizers of community.
And it's been pointed out any number of times, even on those shows where there's block A, block B, block C.
Right.
But it just seems to be something that dissipates into thin air. It's not a point that people take very seriously. Every group commits crimes, but immigrant groups, according to the statistics, commit fewer crimes.
Right. They have more to lose.
Proportionally.
And the other thing, too, is that, and this is why the Democrats, they haven't yet really countered the Trump message effectively. So it's making it look like that they're not compromising and that they're obstructionist. One of the things we have to look at is what is setting in motion this wave of humanity from the South. And if you have any kind of, I remember when I was doing reporting at WNYC about day laborers that were in Monmouth County from Chiapas. That was the area they were moving in from Mexico. And I interviewed a fellow who had been a pediatrician in Mexico, but left his community because what had happened was when the U.S. had NAFTA, the multinational corn that the U.S. was selling destroyed the subsistence farming that was going on in Chiapas. So this brilliant young man, who no doubt had a role in healing his community, made more money as a landscaping crew chief cutting lawns in New Jersey. And then add into it how this country's addictions in terms of drugs are driving the narco-terrorism that people are escaping. So we have a role to play in what's driving that migrant traffic.
According to the polls, the president hasn't made a strong enough case for a $5.7 billion, quote, powerful see-through steel barrier to convince a majority of the American public. And the pundits on CNN and MSNBC are predicting that he's going to lose if he decides to run again in 2020.
I don't know that the country can stand it, and I think we need to set the precedent and get those mass muscles going of tossing him up before then. But
we have 2 years to go.
I know, exactly. And I think one of the things that's happening is that nothing gets in the way of ambition. When I see these people setting up, "I'm going to run for president" thing, they are kind of making this moment about them, and I think the timing is unfortunate. I think that when this many American workers, federal workers, are suffering, really, that for them to insert themselves as now the Joan of Arc of the moment, or you make, I think that's a mistake politically. And anything that takes air out of focusing on making Trump pay a political price for what he's doing right now, it, to me, is more narcissism. That's kind of ironic, because that's what, you know, Donald Trump is all about.
One of the big stories right now is the apology tours of so many of these potential candidates.
Well, and I think that one of the things is that anything, and that's why it's going to be so important to say what the visuals are coming out of the Hart protest at the Senate office building today. I hope when I go back to the office and look at the footage from that, what I see is Mr. Trumpka, national labor leaders getting arrested. It's very important, even if we're not going to do a general strike, that Randy Weingarten, the people that have made a good living and been leaders in the union movement, need to be seen as getting arrested as part of this protest.
Well, the president continues to describe people in opposition to his steel barrier as the extreme voices who fear compromise and demand open borders, which means drugs pouring in, human trafficking, and a lot of crime.
Right, and that's sophistry. I mean, that's why he's holding on to that base.
So Randy Weingarten is a...
Absolutely.
Is a commie.
And that's why every time the mainstream media cast that speech on Saturday as a compromise or an attempt of him trying to bring things together, written in everything in there, just like the poison pill provisions and the thing McConnell's going to put up, it's all about just holding on to their partisan advantage.
And what are some of the poison pill provisions?
Well, there's...
I mean, other than...
The big one is...
The DACA, only 3 years.
Well, the other big one is that you're going to seek asylum in your local capital. Now, I'll tell you, if you're being running away from drug gangs, you're not going to say, you know what, I'm going to go to the capital, my national capital, that's always been so supportive, not. Mm-hmm.
So, Managua, you go to Managua if you want to get out of Nicaragua.
Right. Oh, this is such a great and open government. I can't wait.
In his Saturday address, the president made no mention of the suffering of federal employees. Who this Friday will go without a second paycheck. Although just down the block on Pennsylvania Avenue, Jose Andres is running a soup kitchen.
And that's one of the things that is the secondary benefit here, and that's why anyone who doesn't get engaged in this is going to regret it. That's an example of leadership. We have Mr. Rappaport, who has the a Jewish soup kitchen here, the kosher soup kitchen in Brooklyn, reaching out to federal workers. You have this grassroots response from people who know that this is a time we have to stand with each other. And in that moment, we can redefine the power structure. But you have to have the vision, just like is happening in Washington, to put something at risk.
The president is often accused of lacking empathy, but is... it really possible that no one in his administration has thought about how this thing looks?
Everything, what do they say in The Sopranos? A fish rots from the head. Okay, so I had an opportunity to talk to Donald Trump in 2015 when I was still at CBS Money Watch. And what I did in that case was I felt that he wasn't being held responsible as a candidate for what the ruin that he did in Atlantic City. So what I did was I called ministers in Atlantic City who I'd seen in the paper on social justice causes, and I said, do you have anyone in the congregation who was messed up by Donald Trump, whose life, because of his bankruptcies, ended up upending them? And I got all these calls from these carpet installers, people who had florist shops, whose lives were ruined because this guy decided not to pay them or give them a fraction of what they were owed. This was a strategy. This is the way he works. It is like, it's like salting the earth. If you go up against him, it's like the mob. He will just completely ruin you. And fear of that is how he, that's how he runs. He's taking that same principle and using it in this conflict.
In this case, the people who are most affected tend to be women and people of color. The people who have the least power in this country.
Well, and exactly, and that also gets to the fact that they have been the Republicans, the faction that is so closely aligned with them. For instance, you know, they've been going after food stamps for years, for decades. Republicans from red states, farmers, had a common cause with the urban Democrats from urban states, and that's how food stamps came to exist. And it was one of those things that was fine. And then this conservative GOP faction blew that consensus apart, and they were going after food stamps just before the shutdown. So for them, there's a secondary gain here, the more dysfunction that happens. You think they're upset that New York City, a sanctuary city where all these people live, is going to be $500 million down in terms of feeding people that are most insecure? No, this is a strategy. This isn't an accident.
Some Republican members of Congress have said off the record that if the TSA workers went on strike, that would end the shutdown.
I think that would be so, but I think that it's time for us to take some heat off of them, because once again, if they do it alone, then they'll just, you know, toss them out. It's time for everybody. I mean, what would happen if people decided, you know what, I'm not going to do that business trip. I'm just going to stand in solidarity for one day. Then it takes the heat off the TSA. It takes the heat off the workers because they've got no business.
This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI. 99.5 FM in New York. We invite you to join this conversation with Bob Henley. Our number here is 212-209-2877. Federal workers pin blame on Trump for shutdown.
Yeah, that's what I encountered.
So in the end, how significant is that?
Well, I think it already started being significant in 2018. I talked to AFG Vice President Phil Glover, who was handling AFG's efforts in Pennsylvania, which was pivotal. And he said that he had seen an interest, an upsurge in energy from workers in terms of supporting candidates for Congress. And even in terms of recruiting people, one of the things is this happened wide and deep in terms of the turnaround, and they believe that the federal workers were a key part.
Did anybody look into the percentage of federal workers who voted for the Democrats, who had might have voted for Donald Trump in the previous election?
I think what we saw, I didn't really see any data on that, but what is it was clear that they had events in all 50 states, so they attempted and they pulled off a major organizing effort and worked across different union group. So you had AFL, teachers, everybody working together. That's why I think this is an opportunity to take those intramural muscles they developed in 2018 and then really use them in some kind of action that emphasizes that this country needs to reorder its priorities. The fact that federal workers are in their situation is a result of Donald Trump, but also of the neglect of working people in the post-World War II environment. That's the other thing here, is that people have continued to struggle. And even during President Obama's period of time, wealth concentration continued. The way they resolved the 2008 meltdown, nobody was prosecuted, and you had $20 trillion in household wealth that was lost. This is still having major effects in communities of color throughout this country, where people have lost generational wealth that they won't get back.
A deal for funding the government without border wall money was approved by the Senate by a 100-0 vote when the Republicans control both houses. So what happened? Is it simply Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh have more power than anyone else in this country?
I think, of course, that it was a confluence of things like history is. And one of the things that happened was Donald Trump has been a master at changing the conversation at a crucial point. So it served his interest after he heard the prompting from Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter that he needed to keep his commitment and get back to the basics of the wall. It also was starting to look like he had an increasing problem with what was happening with the Mueller investigation. So by doing this, he's reordered that A, B, and C block.
As a journalist, do you envy the power of Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh to affect policy?
No.
You wouldn't want to write an article and your article calls for a general strike, but I hate to let you know this.
Right.
There isn't going to be a general strike.
We'll see.
We have a caller. Our number here, by the way, is 212-209-2877. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Just in regard to, like, Trump, to me, he's not the disease, he's the symptom of the problem that's been going on since, well, economically, politically, you know, since the end of the Vietnam War.
Yeah, I think that analysis I'd agree with you on. I think that it's something really happened that was strange in the country that's not enough noted. in the 1970s, around 73, 74, productivity had gone up, and then wages had been going up. I mean, one of the things I said in one of the Salon pieces is that from 1929 up until like 1972 or 73, the share of income of the top 1% declined. And that came during a time of tremendous expansion of the middle class. And then in the early 70s, the percentage of wealth held by the 1% grew, and now it's growing exponentially. And as a consequence, the middle class began to shrink. And everyone, this also happened at the same time as we increasingly found the social contract between capital and work deteriorate, so that people were waiting by the phone to see if they get to work that day.
Yeah. And also, one more thing. Also, you saw the emergence of think tanks like the American Enterprise Institute, as well as, you know, the growing neoliberal economic agenda. I guess it started by the Carter, from the time of the Carter administration.
I think it even got off to this idea of think tanks, and the revolving government really took off also during the Clinton era. And it also set the stage for the political fixers, the idea of the global trotters. And, you know, you'll have someone like Manafort, but there's Democratic folks that do the same thing, who feel they take their national prestige and access and go around and mess around in other people's geopolitical situation.
And we can't see this totally as Democrats versus Republicans, because Bill Clinton signed a welfare reform bill, if you want to call it reform, right, that really hurt an awful lot of people.
Well, and even during his whole pro-trade, free trade approach really set the stage for a lot of things that Trump exploited. I mean, that's one of the things that really hurt Secretary Clinton in the campaign, was Trump reflecting back on the policies that, through supporting her husband, she'd signed on to, that resulted in the hollowing out of middle America.
Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As a business owner and someone who just did quarterly taxes, maybe just New York and California withhold our federal taxes for, you know, an equal amount of time. And I think this issue will be resolved pretty quickly.
That's brilliant. I mean, one of the things that's gone on for a long time is a transfer of wealth that's happened between states like California and New York and New Jersey, particularly New York and New Jersey, where you have some level of expertise. And that is that we give far more than we ever get back. And the donor states, the states that receive what's donated, are the red states. So the very ones that are anti-federal government are the ones that have been the largest beneficiaries of the circumstance since the Second World War.
Thanks for your call. Bob, you write, traditionally, the annual Martin Luther King holiday is a time when we reflect on the progress we've made on the social agenda that King gave his life in to advance. But in regard to two major priorities of Dr. King, curbing American militarism and advancing economic justice, it doesn't seem like we're headed in the right direction.
No, in fact, one of the things that we mentioned in the beginning was this robo-militarism, which is just reflexive at this point. And after 9/11, remember, there was supposed to be a peace dividend from the stand down of the Soviet Union, and what resulted is 9/11 came along and a new mandate came along. And I did discuss the growing wealth inequality. This is a far more unequal country economically than it was when King died.
And you use New Jersey as an example of how we're failing in the area of economic justice in the United States. Why is New Jersey a particularly good example of,
there's a,
of how
there's
we're
a, there's several states that are close to places where Wall Street's happening, and where like you have Silicon Valley, or people making incredible amounts of money. I think some data shows that the average income in the 1% is like $1.5 million, and the average income in New Jersey for the bottom 99% is like in the 60s or 70s. So you have this kind of whacked out situation. And on top of that, you have an entire generation that's been shackled by student debt. So you have $1.5 trillion weighing on millennials, who now are in a position where they can't buy a home, and we even have issues of a declining birth rate and people not doing household formation because of the greed at the top.
And the income gap is growing. I heard a report. I can't remember the number, but it used to be like 25 families had more money right. than the rest of the world, and now it's down to something like 10 or 12.
Yeah, Oxfam had the data. And so that's why I say that this idea of a general strike, its moment may be approaching only because this is the way we get at all these issues.
Let's take another call. WBAI, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call and you guys' critique on and following the dollar. You know, when you critique something and you add money to the mix, it all makes sense. And I thank your guest for the awesome critique. And I just want to expand on his headline. He should have included labor leaders call for a general strike on Super Bowl Sunday. You know, I think that'll rattle Trump's chair right there. You know,
yes.
As long as nobody kneels.
Yeah, you know, I also appreciate you expanding and reiterating the fact that 11 million U.S. citizens lost their home in 2008, and nothing was done, and everybody's keeping quiet about it, and you know. And thank you for your interview, and I'll continue listening.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for calling. There's been a lot of talk about the $15 an hour minimum wage and how it might help out hourly workers. But you write, Trenton's $15 an hour wage deal is one small incremental step in the right direction. Even the $15 an hour doesn't go far enough.
Right. Well, this is one of my insider NJ. I write for them, and we were following, we had a situation where it was a major campaign commitment. Phil Murphy, running for governor, was going to get a $15 an hour minimum wage. And then it got caught up in personalities, and the guys at the top, well, I'm going to sit down with you and talk about it. You sit down with me. Meanwhile, they didn't keep the commitment. Well, finally, it looked like they have a deal. But the reality is, it's going to be in a few years that this actually happens. And it cuts out farm workers. I mean, this is crazy. And so the reality is it costs like $23, $24 an hour in living in certain counties to make a go of it. And I would add one other thing that's very important is the United Way has a data point that they look at. And this is something they've done, started in New Jersey and then is now rolled out across the country. And they look at what it actually costs for a family to survive. And they call it the ALICE statistic. It's asset limited, income constrained, but employed. And believe it or not, Leonard, in New Jersey, almost 40% of the states living below the poverty line are struggling week to week to make ends meet.
37% live below the poverty line.
Right.
Another 39% struggle week to week. That leaves just one in four that are really making
it. That is single mothers. And that percentage is, and that is a group where the majority of people, and these are folks that we want to hold up, right? They're people who are trying to advance the cause of their children and often under-resourced. And those are the ones that are having the hardest time. And that's why I thought the $15 an hour raise should have happened right away.
Although I've spoken to some small restaurant owners about the $15 minimum wage, and they tell me that it's putting them out of business. Because if they pay the dishwasher $15, then the line cooks now want a bigger raise, and it goes up and up and up, and they can't afford to stay in business.
Well, I would say, and I have no doubt you're very close to the restaurateur community, but I think
I have a few friends.
Yes, you do.
But a listener also called to ask why so many restaurants are going out of business.
Well, that's a whole thing. If we want to talk about, for instance, what's happened to real estate in New York, I'll do that for 500. I mean, when you're in a city where no one wants to sign a lease unless you're a CVS or TD Bank because they want a lease that goes on for 20 years, there's a lot of things at play that pressure restaurants out of business.
Let's take another call. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Am I on the air?
Yes.
Yep.
I that's what I just told you. WBAI,
okay,
you're on
well,
the air.
My name is Diana Montford. I'm transgender. I do the Diana Montford Show on Public Access. I'm a clearinghouse for transgender concerns. Now, these people, the trans community, many are on public assistance. Many, most, are on food stamps. They are terrified that they are going to starve to death in the streets because they're not going to get their government subsidies for housing. They're not going to get their food stamps. What are they going to do? Trump is attacking the least powerful among us,
And the Supreme Court just supported him.
Which, yes, yesterday, that hideous law that trans people are not allowed to enter the military or be in the military. And that is just, I mean, that's not the American way.
Well,
what can we do?
Well, that's why I like the tone of urgency in your voice exactly matches the moment. I mean, every time I listen to MSNBC and it's the same old, Putin, Putin, Putin all around the clock, you're talking about the circumstance people are facing in a way that matches the desperation that is going to be upon them. One of the things that I know New York City, Mayor de Blasio had a press conference about this, the USDA did front load, and many states are taking advantage of it, your SNAP benefits for people who are relying on this. You may have gotten an additional payment for February. There's tremendous concern that folks will blow through that because they won't know that this has to last them. And so you raise the central most important issue. This is not about politics. It's about humanity.
We have time to slip one more call in. Hi, WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, I always listen to Mr. Henley on Michael's show in the morning, but Have any of you guys read Democracy in Chains?
No.
I mean, this started like right after Brown versus Board of Education in the 50s with the Republican Party and the Koch brothers and their little think tank that they have at University of Virginia. You know, and if you guys read that book, you'll see that this plan has been put into effect a long time ago with this Republican Party. And I'm not saying all Democrats are good either.
Right.
You know, because, you know, I'm 63 years old, you know, and I've lived a long time. And I know after reading that book, and I'm a college grad and well-read, but if you read that book, you will see this plan that brought Trump to us started a long time ago.
I'll look it up. Thanks.
Although it is interesting that on Martin Luther King days for years, the fact that Barack Obama was elected president twice was cited as tangible evidence that we had been making the progress that he been calling for.
I will say to you that it's it's tragic, but the reality is African Americans achieved the White House and many of them lost their own house. And that's not discussed enough.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I want to talk about another topic for just a few moments.
Okay.
You wrote a while back about the corporatization of public radio stations, most notably the one we used to work at, WNYC. Do you think that things will change after Laura Walker and a number of the board members leave in the coming months?
I think, wow, that's – and by the way, you have a few minutes left. That should be really another show. You haven't lost your charm, Leonard. I would say, pressed by the clock and the circumstance, to say that...
Well, you have about 5 minutes.
Yeah, I would say that the key challenge there is to deal with the fact that it expanded very quickly, and this is something that the New York Times took note of, and I've written about it, that WNYC expanded tremendously from being a publicly owned entity when it was a municipal station. In the process of expanding, they got themselves in a marginal labor situation where they had an awful lot of talented young people who had all kinds of tangential relationships with the station. Again, it goes back to that social labor contract. While I was there, I saw a proliferation of 1099 temporary individuals who, if they had 1,000 hours, then they have to be terminated or they have to be hired. A lot of young people made the Faustian bargain not to put in for their time, to extend the period of time they would be there. Because every so often, like a Marlon Brando shape-up, a couple of them might get a job. So they'd hang on there in hopes of that. And they had interns and the rest. And so what happened was it created a culture where there wasn't respect. And I do think that it was a situation where women and men, but also women, didn't sense they could speak up because they were marginal to the workforce. And if they said anything, they would have a serious problem. And so I think they have to resolve that. I think they have to bring in all the folks that are outside the union now because they have a split shop where a majority of people that work there aren't in a union. They need to be represented across the board. And I would tell you that after SAG and the non-union members need to have a member on the board. Get with it, people. That's the progressive thing they have to do. They have to have representation on the board of trustees because right now it's dominated by the people that wheel and deal stations, sell a station to Sinclair. I mean, that's the problem. everything, you know, this is the issue. They don't want to lose their soul. I know they want to make this huge payday and payroll, but they have to make sure that the people making the product have a role in the direction of the station.
Doesn't the problem go back quite a while? PBS stations have been running what I might call commercials. They would call them
right.
something else for many, many years. And the Supreme Court even, was it the Supreme Court that decided that that was okay?
Well, one of the things here I will say to you is that we have, you know, in the British broadcasting system, we have a different, they have a different system
well,
of support.
Well, they charge license fees to everybody, even people who don't
right.
listen to the BBC.
And so what's happened is you've deregulated. What happened is broadcast licenses became property rights. They used to be privileges where all stations had to have news and public affairs. Through the Republicans and even Democrats, it was turned into a property right where it's no longer a privilege, but it's real estate. And that's part of the problem. And you can't, you need to address that if you want to talk about the public broadcasting space.
On the other hand, many people will argue that programs like news programs like Morning Edition and All Things Considered are the only, are probably the best that you can get right now.
I think the
BBC as well
right.
is offered on many of those stations.
That's true. And we have a lot of colleagues that are still there working there. But I would say to you, when you have a situation where Purdue Pharma is supporting it, known to have set the opioid crisis into motion, it's a tough thing to square and then to try to do aggressive reporting. And there's too much pro-corporate worldview. That's why they missed the election of Donald Trump. They missed the suffering at the center of America's Main Street.
So public broadcasting missed it. Everybody missed it. I remember reading the New York Times the day before, and they said the polls indicate that Hillary Clinton is a shoo-in.
Well, and that's because they have an economic narrative that looks at the aggregate unemployment. And I've written a lot about this. They look at the aggregate unemployment rate that shows what's happening, but no one lives in the aggregate. And now we've lost basic reporters at the county level. I mean, that's the other thing, too, is we don't have people doing the basic reporting about economic realities at the center of American life.
Do you think there's also just too cozy a relationship between, we'll say, the New York Times, the New Yorker, and a station like WNYC?
Well, when they get into, I'm going to cross-promote, and with our contribution, you get a New York Times subscription, a New Yorker contribution, and we bring you a New Yorker program that's produced by WNYC that the New York Times had one day in a story. Yes, it is all too involved. And that was the denouement of that was, and I know you can't comment on this, but Laura Walker sitting on the board of Tribune Broadcasting when they were trying to have this dastardly merger with Sinclair. Really?
Sinclair being a very
right-wing, right. It was supposed to be the new Fox. Mm-hmm. And to have the person that is leading public radio, the flagship station at WNYC in the country, also part of this merger that Trump wanted, it raises a lot of complications.
We invited Bob Hennelly here to talk about his two-part article in Salon headed It's Time for a General Strike Against Trump. But we've talked about a lot of other things.
Yes, we did.
It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks,
Bob. Thank
pleasure.
You so much.
Hope you have me back.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Bob Hennelly, to Angela Sheldon, who produced the segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.